thing that I see, they were not listening.
Yeah.
They feel confident. They don't feel confident.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. We will open this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Services. And the first little reminder I keep leaving myself little notes about is that when the blue light is on, the microphones are on. And we have also noted that the microphones, even when the blue light goes off after the meeting, are picking up some of the comments. That's been reported back to me. So you might, keep that in mind. Fair warning. There you go. We have three measures set for public hearing today, so we're going to try to keep this flowing right along. And the first is a public hearing. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2178. And if our Mr. Molina could kind of brief the committee on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2178 establishes campus veteran service officer program in the Department of Veterans Affairs and places veterans service officers on Oregon Community College and University campuses.
Thank you. And I have a list of folks here. I think it matches up with the at least as many folks as I was expecting to speak to this bill today. So I think what the way we'd like to structure it is to open with Paul Evans, Mike Burton, Jim Willis, who could kind of brief us on the task force recommendation on bringing this bill forward. And Mr. Burton, I think you also have a little insight on the pilot that was done at Portland State. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then just for fair warning, we'll move on to the Oregon University system. Laura Blake-Jones and whomever else would like to speak at that point. And then we'll talk to the veteran service officers, Joseph Riley and Tim Jetterberg. So that's kind of the way I envision this moving along today. Go right ahead.
Okay. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to come before you. There are a number of bills related to the task force recommendations. This one is actually what we believe is as one of the most important pieces because it, again, goes back to trying to expand access. In terms of context, I just wanted to kind of refresh a couple of numbers that we handed out a while back having to do with the task force. 350,000 veterans are currently in Oregon, according to the census. 80,000 veterans are currently enrolled in the VA system in its many different forms. 270,000 veterans are currently not enrolled. We view that the approach to outreach to veterans has many different tiers. Added to that, with the recent passage in the Congress of the new GI Bill, we believe that what we need to focus on in the next several years is to help facilitate veterans taking full advantage of the new GI Bill. And that led us to this particular suggestion and recommendation. The goal right now is, because of our fiscally constrained times, to both emphasize the value of a VSO on every campus, community college campus, university campus, but also recognize that in recognition of the current budget climate, that we can't afford everything we want. So we're asking today, with the bill that's before you, 5 of the 17 positions for campus veteran service officers. This isn't really a new program as much as an emphasis on the role of a campus community. Every aspect of the outreach programs that currently exist in terms of veteran service officers is unique and vital. The county veteran service officers fulfill a critical need in the local areas. The state veteran service officers that cover portions of Multnomah County as well as all of Marion and Polk County and do the other force multiplier jobs are critical. We believe a third leg of that approach is the campus veteran service officers. Currently, as envisioned, that program will be on a circuit rider program, where each of the 5 VSOs that we bring on will have several different campuses at first, and we believe that the program will prove itself over time. Again, in terms of context, we currently have 65 veteran service officers in the state of Oregon. Those 65 veteran service officers help bring in about $1.12 billion a year. We believe that at this point we need lots and lots of VSOs in every category because it will provide opportunities to A, help the veterans, and B, bring revenues into the state that will offset other expenses. But this two-year time frame, the task force believes the priority is the five VSOs at the campuses. And I will stop there and pass the baton.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm Vice Provost at Portland State University and was a member, a member of the Governor's Task Force. I was here a couple weeks ago reporting on that to you. At that time, I mentioned that we had, through an initiative really initially by some student veterans at Portland State, they asked the university to establish a veterans center on the campus. And so actually Director Willis and I talked about it, and the two of us came up, Portland State and the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration came up with a memorandum of understanding to an agreement to have a veteran services officer at Portland State. The reason for that is that I was surprised to find that we, with 26,000 students at Portland State, we were only aware of 500 of those students who had actually were receiving veterans educational benefits. And it just seemed logical to me that out of 25,000, that was too low. And so there was something wasn't being connected. And when the VSO came onto the campus on that agreement, the first day he was on campus, he put a table out in the quad during New Student Week, put a tablecloth on it, and a sign said, "Veterans got questions, come here." He talked to 65 people that first day. And then later in the day, began to move 16 of those individuals in because they didn't know they were entitled to veterans benefits. That was part of it. If you recall, when I was down here before, they simply didn't know that. Ultimately, within a term, he had signed up 35 individuals to begin getting their educational benefits from us. That, in a dollar sense, is roughly $5,000 per student in getting financial educational aid that they didn't know about. That's important. So getting sort of getting the eligible veterans in the door is part of that first cause, and having someone physically present on the campus in a good location was what we felt was part of the trick. But part of the next question is, how do you retain veterans? And of course, retention is a big issue for all the universities and colleges. And veterans have the same issues any other student does, maybe a few more. A lot of them are older, married, working part-time, and they need help with housing. They need help with daycare, accessibility, things like this. So they need a place to go to sort of be with their fellow veterans, feel comfortable, and have sort of a one-stop shop. So that's the next thing we're trying to establish. I've got a handout here. I'll hold on to these right now. It sort of talks about some of the things we're trying to do up there. The program at Portland State, having that VSO on campus, was extremely successful. The other thing about it is he didn't spend all of his time at Portland State, because we have agreements, Portland State does, with the community colleges in the area, Clackamas Community College, Portland Community College, and Mount Hood Community College. And so he did a circuit riding and went to those campuses, worked with the veterans offices on each one of those community college campuses, and was able to help those veterans there accelerate their benefits or establish their benefits in the first place. So for Portland State, certainly, in that very short time that we had a veteran services officer on the campus and working with the community colleges as we do, it was extremely valuable to us. My guess is that most of the students, most of the veterans that are coming out and eligible for veterans benefits are probably going to look for trade schools, community college, and then university. So they're going to be across the board. But having that individual at a central location for accessing those other training and educational opportunities has been extremely valuable, and that's why certainly Portland State is in favor of this measure. We have that experience with it. We hope to be able to carry on with Director Willis and the ODVA for that kind of program in the future.
Thank you. Director Willis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here in support of House Bill 2178, and I'd like to echo what Dr. Burton just told you about our experiment at Portland State. I wish we could have continued that. We simply did not have the personnel or the funds to do it, but it more than paid for itself in a very brief period of time. Our concern about this particular program is that, we'd like to cover the entire state. These five full-time equivalencies that are proposed in the first 2 years of this implementation will, in fact, be able to reach a major university setting for the base of operation and then travel to the community colleges that are the feeder colleges for that particular university area. Where exactly these folks are going to go is going to be determined, of course, on the successful passage of the bill, by sitting down in the interim with higher ed, determining where our populations are, where we can best serve the largest number of veterans. And I would anticipate us making a return during the interim to this committee or any committee we're directed to tell you the progress that we've made. In addition to that, I've asked the manager of our education, training, and outreach program, whose responsibility it will be to supervise this on a statewide basis, to ensure that we conduct quarterly meetings with the county veteran service people that are in the areas where these officers are serving, that they also agree to conduct case-by-case basis where there is a case that probably is better served by one or the other, and that's done by simple communication with each other. And then also, we train a couple of times a year for the accredited service officers in our state, and I think it's just a responsible thing on our part to give a continuous update on how the University and Community College Veteran Service Program is going, what people can do to help assist us in making it better and stronger, and what resources might be used to help from a county and municipal level to direct veterans to their educational benefits. And I'll stop by saying I'm very encouraged by the Congress's passing of the post-9/11 GI Bill. It is the most comprehensive GI Bill since the World War II, since the one that passed at the end of World War II, and it has comprehensive assistance, it has a stipend, it has money for books, and it pays the tuition at the highest rate of the highest university. So the more people we can get in our community college and university system, the better it's going to be for our economy and the better it's going to be for our higher educational system. And at the end of the day, the better it's going to be for our society, because we're going to have a number of well-educated individuals ready to join the workforce and lead from the front with regard to how we implemented this bill. This bill becomes effective in August of 2009. It's on time and on track, according to my contacts in the federal VA. They're going to be ready, and so our responsibility is we're going to need to be ready when they are. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony in support of House Bill 2178.
Thank you. We have a fairly packed group of agenda today with various people waiting to testify on all three of these bills. So are there any specific, fairly brief questions for this particular group at this point? Representative Boone.
Is this the same program that Sergeant Benjamin Heyer was involved with?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, yes. In fact, he's a Portland State graduate, and he was one of the individuals who really gathered some veteran students at Portland State and wanted to, so he was actually the first person brought to my attention, and he's to be thanked for that.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're looking at cutting to five. Has there been any looks at maybe having like a Veterans Resource Center with numbers they could call to reach out to all the communities or the different schools that are out there, and maybe with the budget crisis we're in right now, where we could save some money and maybe attack this that direction?
Yes, Representative Widener and Chair Cowan, members of the committee, we do have this on our website now. That includes access to the university system and a listing of the veterans' benefits that are available to them for education. So I would anticipate as this new benefit becomes available that we'll have all the how-tos and the frequently asked questions for the veterans to access electronically on our website. Yes, sir.
If I could, Madam Chair, we're at Portland State, and part of the process we're going through right now is redesigning our website to make it more visible for veterans on how to, because right now, if you go on, you don't know how to find that. And then we'll have these links to the other community resources for vets that come in.
That's right.
That's how they get their information.
Thank you.
Chair Cowan, Representative White, if I could just add on to that. One of the real purposes of this effort, and I want to thank the higher ed department and the community colleges for being a willing and active partner in this, is that as campus by campus, we try to make space available and help try to find a place that's safe for veterans. There may not be a VSO there at all times, but it will be a place that they can go to try to get their answers and feel more comfortable. And we feel that that's one of the more important things as well. And higher ed has absolutely been great in trying to make this partnership happen.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to bring up now Laura Blake Jones and Jim Seger. Did you want to join her? Or? And whomever else is joining you. Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Laura Blake Jones, the Interim Dean of Students at the University of Oregon, and I've brought with me today Jason Alves, who is the student director of our Veterans and Families Student Association at the University of Oregon. Are you going to introduce yourself?
No, I'll do it when I do.
Okay. Okay. And we're here today to speak on behalf of the importance of funding these positions on our campuses. And I'll just give a brief overview. We would welcome any additional resources in being able to meet the needs of our veterans returning to campuses, and want to tell you what we've done at the U of O already and how this person would connect to a well-established network of resources on our campus. We currently have 1.33 FTE dedicated at the University of Oregon to work with veterans. One of those FTEs is in our registrar's office and is primarily consumed with the paperwork around veterans' benefits and making sure that students access what has available to them. The 0.33 FTE is part of a staff member in my office who works collaboratively with a number of other student affairs programs and services to make sure that the students returning to campus get the specific support that they need. The things that have come out of this have been expanded training for our counseling and testing center to make sure that they are able to meet the needs of PTSD and other anxiety and depression issues, work with our health center staff to sensitize them to the issues with disability services and our shuttle resources. But the most important thing from my perspective that's come out of this has been the establishment of our student organization. And Jason can speak more to that in just a minute. But the Veterans and Families Student Organization has been able to become recognized by our student government, receive a space allocation in our student union. Those other services that I mentioned are housed in Oregon Hall, which is a more administrative building. So they've been able to form that gathering spot and place for veterans to come together and be together. The things that have come out of this has been an array of programming and support for students, the informal mentoring that they need, the creation of a theater production on our campus that allows veterans to tell their stories. It's a production called Telling, and share their personal experiences with others as they've been through what they've been through and then come back to be students on our campus. They do annual awareness week programming, all sorts of educational work. We have a work group on campus that meets to look at the emerging needs and things that maybe we hadn't anticipated about policies that might get in the way of students needing something different for their specific situations. And then finally, Jason's going to talk in a minute about a grant that we're applying for right now that would be able to extend this student organization into even a formalized mentorship program. So every campus is going to be different. How folks are going to do this on their respective campuses may vary. But at the University of Oregon, I can't say enough about how important this has been for Jason and the students that have come before him who've had this organization over the last 4 years.
The Veterans and Family Student Association.
Jason, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Appreciate it.
I'm Jason Alves, the director of the Veterans and Family Student Association at the University of Oregon.
Could I catch the spelling on your last name?
Alves, A-L-V-E-S.
Thank you.
The Veterans and Family Student Association, our primary goals is to provide a community within a community at the University of Oregon. A number of our veterans that are returning to school and stuff like that are usually a little bit older than the average student, and they have a little bit different life and experience and stuff like that. So to be able to provide this community, we've been able to see a lot more success with the Paul Evans was talking about, was retention, actual recruitment to the universities and stuff like that. We also do a lot of advocating for our members and stuff like that, and that's where a lot of the events that have taken place for Veterans Awareness Week, where we ask members what they'd like to do, and we reached out into the community to help out homeless veterans, and we're actually able to bridge the gap between homeless veterans and the university possibility. Other things that we've been going on is the ACE Walmart grant that we spoke about real quick, and one of the things we want to do with that is create a mentorship program on the campus where it would be essentially a record-tracking kind of setup where a veteran would be able to help out and be able to step in as soon as the grades start slipping or if maybe they're not attending all the classes and stuff like that. So.
Communication station.
Oh, and then we just procured funds from the student government to go ahead and put in a communication stations at the University of Oregon. In the Eugene-Springfield area, there's nothing in place right now for anybody that's, well, there's no computer system set aside just to be able to contact loved ones that are overseas and stuff like that. So we got money through the student government to go ahead and put in a computer system that's put aside just for that, and that's in our office right now. So, and we just actually yesterday took a first trial run and everything like that, and everything works, so that's exciting. So
that's a good thing.
Yeah. So.
Any questions for these folks? Representative Matthews.
I just want to say how encouraging it is, Jason, and thank you very much. It's, you know, with veterans groups and whatnot, we're always reaching out, and a lot of times it's the older generations that's looking back and saying, how can we help our veterans? I remember what it was like when I was a veteran. So I think it's really encouraging when you see a student group association that comes forward and says, we want to help and get involved and with the U of O. And so I guess the only question I have towards the U of O would be, first of all, thanks for your effort, but you have 1.33 FTEs now, but obviously with the Veteran Service Officer, with this program, you're in favor of it. This would allow you to do a lot more on campus, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and how would you see this position being utilized different than the positions that you currently have?
We would definitely want to work with the folks that are setting this up to see how they would want to connect us with our existing services, and we haven't had those conversations. But I know with the person that works in my office, she's dividing her time currently between serving other non-traditional students, so students who are not traditional age, who return after a gap and being able to pursue their education. And, you know, it's a third of her, essentially. So I know we could provide greater support and infrastructure to the student organization if we had additional FTE. That outreach work with the committee of folks that extends to the other parts of the campus, working with faculty, working with our other student affairs departments in expanding their services, they would have the time and the opportunity to be able to put towards those other endeavors as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sager.
Yes, Chair Cowan, members of the committee, James Sager from the Governor's Office. Very quickly, I just want to put the exclamation point on the Governor's support for this piece of legislation. It is so important, as we have all talked about, supporting our veterans and our National Guard men and women as they're deployed overseas or working the fire lines in the state of Oregon. But we also need to make sure that we continue every way possible to support them in getting access to both education and other programs. And again, we compliment the work of the commission to really identify where the focal point in the system needs to be, and that is on the campuses around the state, to both open up those doors to education and training, but also provide that safe, inviting environment for the veteran so that he or she can come in and find out what else, in addition to education, that they have access to, and actually have a conversation with somebody that, as I say, they feel comfortable with, they relate to, and who understands the kinds of challenges that they're facing. So, again, our support, the education community has really rallied to help, as you've heard, and hopefully this can be a very bipartisan, positive legislative action. Thank you.
You feel like you're in a position to elaborate a little bit on how the education community has rallied around to support this concept?
Well,
or am I putting you on the spot?
Chair Cowan, you're somewhat putting me on the spot, but no, I think I can address it somewhat. And that is, so oftentimes we come up with what we believe are wonderful ideas, and then we tell the people who are supposed to provide it, you know, go and take care of it, and they have to absorb the cost, and they have to try and figure out what we mean, et cetera. the community colleges and the university system, in part because they have been doing things already as best they can, as we've heard from University of Oregon. But the members, people from these campuses have really stepped forward and said, we're going to figure out a way to find office space to help advertise, get the word out, to tie our web pages to the system, because they too recognize that we owe this to our veterans, and that a large percentage of their both current student population and potential student population are in fact veterans and qualify for benefits, and therefore it's incumbent upon the education system to help access those benefits so, in fact, people can both attend and be successful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can the older vets avail themselves of these services, too, on campus?
Within the Veterans and Family, I want to speak to what you said earlier. Within the Veterans and Family Student Association, we have a number of Vietnam veterans that come down there and use our services. Not necessarily use our service, but they're there in the office. And it helps out with the returning veterans, the newer guys, and then it also helps them out in turn. So.
Thank you. I could just add one piece to that. We framed ours the Veterans and Family Student Association, so this group is also supporting the families with veterans deployed, and that was another piece of the need that we had.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to call up now Joseph Riley and Tim Jetterberg. Are you with? Okay, good enough. Coming.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Riley. I'm the Lane County Veterans Service Officer and the Vice President of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association. I've submitted written testimony details in two pages, what service officers do in general, what the county veteran service officers do. I'd like to just hit a couple of those highlights as I see there's some new members of this committee from last session. And I also do want to make clear, I'm appearing today not as an employee of Lane County, but as in my role as the Association Vice President.
Thank you.
County Veteran Service Officers, or CVSOs, are the frontline contacts for the vast majority of veterans who are represented in the state of Oregon. Service organization representation is not required to present a claim to the VA, but many think it's a virtual necessity. In Oregon, represented veterans, on average, as of September of 2004, received annual benefits of $11,890. Unrepresented veterans received $5,187. That $11,000 figure made Oregon sixth in the nation for receipt of service-connected compensation for our veterans who are awarded benefits. To accomplish the goal of representing our veterans and to effectively advocate for our clients before the VA, CVSOs gain specialized knowledge of the arcane world that is the VA. CVSOs meet with veterans day in and day out to try to help him or her understand, A, what the VA is trying to say, and sometimes even more difficult, explain why the VA thinks they have to say what they're trying to say. We sit down with our clients, the veteran, his widow, their children. It's the most rewarding job in the world that I know of. It can also be one of the most frustrating jobs in the world to work with the VA every day. Working to help veterans and his or her family is our main focus, and I truly believe that that is at the heart of everyone in this room today. We all want to do that in the best way possible. To this end, I don't know anyone who would deny that we need more service officers in Oregon. So I'd like to address 2178 specifically for a moment, if I may.
Please.
As I stated, we support more service officers in Oregon. We also support specialized service officers to help with education benefits and to assist veterans on college campuses. We support the five that is being discussed and was in one of the fiscal reports regarding 2178. We do have some concerns about the discussions that have been had about this bill as it's currently written, however. We're concerned about the lack of discretion that the department has regarding Section 1, Subsection 4. That section appears to require a single service officer for every public institution campus in the state. We're concerned if that's, well, if that's the best use of these resources. I believe the VA's figures show that there's about 6,000 veterans attending Oregon higher education facilities and receiving VA benefits. I think there's a very valid concern that not all veterans going to school are receiving their benefits. If we double that 6,000 and say there's 12,000 veterans going to school, 6,000 of whom are not receiving benefits, 6,000 are, if we're talking about 20 to 24 service officers at these institutions, that's a ratio of about 600 veterans per service officer. Some of the larger institutions, obviously that ratio would be higher. Some of the smaller, it will be much lower, vice versa. For some perspective, Lane County has 3.5 service officers. There's 35,000 veterans in my county. That's an average of 10,000 veterans per service officer. And so while we support these veteran service officers who are specialized in education benefits in an arcane department that is the VA, this is one of the more arcane aspects of it, we do wonder if we need one at every single campus, if some discretion shouldn't be given to the department to better allocate those resources, and if perhaps service officers with a broader mission shouldn't be considered as well. Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Jetterberg. I'm the Union County Veteran Service Officer out in La Grande, Oregon. I'm also president of the County Veteran Service Officers Association, and I'm here today to speak for my association. One of my major concerns with this bill is merely that somehow we have the capacity to communicate with ODVA when these positions are filled, which we certainly support them being filled, so that the claims that are put in that are not educational claims have a smooth transition to us or to some mechanism to follow through with them. Most of the vets that are going to school are not only going to be claiming educational benefits, they're also going to be claiming service-connected disability claims, trying to get medical care, and all the other benefits that are available. My office is right across the street from our local campus. I want to make sure that if that person is starting a claim for those veterans, that they are coordinating either with us or some other accredited rep, or that they have the ability themselves to follow through with all aspects of that veteran's needs, not just the educational part, because that's only a small part of what those veterans need. Most of our Iraqi vets that are coming home, the majority of them do have some sort of a claim for a service-connected disability. I just want to make sure that we're able to coordinate with these folks, and I'm pretty sure we can do it through ODVA. We have a good working relationship with ODVA, and I'm sure that we can get together and do that, but we've got to make sure that that happens. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Wigner.
Thank you, Chair. Just looking at your numbers here, you had Oregon represented veterans on average, and you're back at 2004 for the numbers that you have, and you said we're sixth in the nation. Now, I think earlier, and you might need Paul to clarify this for me, but I thought I heard we were fourth in the nation right now as far as represented benefits, and I'm just kind of curious, here we're 11,890, where we would be at now and how far off we are from the person that's number one. So whoever's number one in the nation, are they 11,901 and we're $11 off, or and get a good idea on that? But these numbers are fairly old that we have here, so I'm kind of curious to see where we are progress-wise.
Chair Cowan, Representative Widener, 2004 is the last VA Office of Inspector General report that I have available that sets forth these stats. Perhaps there's more recent ones available, and I can get back to the committee on that. To address the where are we compared to the number one state, in September of 2004, when that snapshot was taken, New Mexico was at 15,275, so substantial difference. For some perspective, it appears the low was 9,564, Illinois.
I think that what we'll do, this is not the last time we'll discuss this bill, so we'll get some of those questions sort of rolled out, and the next time we bring it back, we'll try to make sure we have answers for some of those things. That's all right. Committee. Any other questions for these two gentlemen? Thank you.
Thank you.
General Caldwell, did you want to contribute to this discussion?
No, I support it.
Okay. Really?
I think you just did.
I believe, let the record show. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, in the interest of what we have scheduled, I think that we'll close the public comment on this bill at this particular point in time. I do want to call attention for the record to the statement we have in front of us from Bill Hall, the chair of the Association of Oregon Counties Human Services Committee, relating to this particular bill. And I believe as we continue the discussion, there's, first of all, we're going to need to get some better information on the fiscal impact and how it's anticipated that that's going to be covered. I've heard a variety of discussions around that, so I think that that would be important information for this committee. Certainly a little more about the plans for coordination and follow through between these more specialized proposed veteran service officers and the existing counting veteran services officers. And I see where the confusion in the current language of the bill is when the proposal is for five FTEs and the bill speaks to one on the campus of each Oregon institution. So you might want to review that to see if we need some amendments and also to kind of clarify some of these questions about current levels of services. Is there anything else that the committee would like to add onto that list of things?
Thank you,
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Chair Cowan, because my concern is in our economic times, how that I served in that Ways and Means Committee, I absolutely support the premise of this bill, but we need more information on how we can make it feasible under the conditions we're dealing
Absolutely. With. Absolutely. I think in a comparative to the amount of revenue that the bill is hopefully going to generate into Oregon's right. system and versus how are we going to manage to cover that cost. Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same lines, I think it would be a good idea to also consider sort of a backup plan if for some reason Ways and Means can't find the money for this. How we would continue the idea of getting veterans connected, whether that's through some of the ideas of the website that was discussed or possibly handing out some information on enrollment. But I think we should not give up if we don't get the funding, continue to look for ideas to get connected.
Just a quick comment.
I guess cut it off.
I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I understand where you're going with that, but I think my point here is we need to reach out to our veterans to be effective. If a website and literature and a billboard were to get this job done, then none of us would have had to knock on a door and contact any of our citizens to get elected. So what we're looking for is how we're going to be effective. And in order to be effective, we got to get boots on the street and people out there shaking hands, getting to know people, and having face-to-face contact to get people enrolled. The other stuff is a great benefit supplemental, and I know this is tough, but we're talking about an incident where we have Oregon veterans that are being deployed currently will be coming home, and they deserve to come home to programs that we can get in place. So,
thank you. Not the time for the committee to discuss this bill.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on 2178, and it will be continued at a future date. I would now like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2024, and if we could get a brief rundown on that bill, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
House Bill, members of the committee, House Bill 2024 would create a Veterans Merit Scholarship Program.
Thank you. And I would also like to call the committee's attention to the fact that I believe you have a copy of House Bill 2033 Did we have one of those in front of us?
Madam Chair, no.
No, we don't. Okay. There may be some testimony that relates there. Just for reference, there is another bill, House Bill 2033, that deals with this same subject. So at some point in time, you may want to reference that as well. So at this point, I think we'll open the testimony with Tom Mann and kind of get an idea of the intention of this bill. And do we want to bring him up at the same time? Is that what you're telling me? No, I know. I'm going to start. I understand the others.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm the Public Information Manager for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'll admit this is not our bill. I don't know a lot about 2024. We actually weren't going to testify on it. We're neutral on the bill. It's not part of the governor's recommended budget. So
okay.
I understand that Mac McDonald is here, however, and your committee administrator was kind enough to invite me to sit with Mac in case you had questions of the department and the piece that talks about the implementation piece in 2024.
Okay, I think this bill came to us at the request of the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs, and unfortunately, for those of you who are having to explain this all over again, not many of us were on that committee, so we're starting from scratch here. So, thank
That's
you.
Fine.
Why don't we go ahead then and bring up Mac McDonald and Kevin O'Reilly? And I do need to note for the record that it is only House Bill 2024 that was scheduled for public hearing today. You can reference the other ones, but officially it was not posted for a hearing today. Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Mac McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which is every federally chartered veterans organization in the state and some that are not federally chartered. This bill is basically to cover a generation that was lost from the federal funding for GI Bill. I'm talking about the Gulf War era. We had the Montgomery GI Bill at that time. Unfortunately, the bill required those people in the service to pay into their own education in order to get any support from the federal government. If you're a private PFC, corporal sergeant, staff sergeant, etc., a lot of those people live below the poverty line, and today a lot of our young veterans are married. They had to make a choice, support my family or try and get an education. I can give you a personal example. I had two children in the service at that time. My son chose not to take the GI Bill. My daughter chose to take it. Fortunately, my son's education is being paid by the union. My daughter's education from this bill was they paid part of her tuition, she paid all the books and all other expenses. This bill is to take that generation that was basically left out by the federal government of education and give them $2,000 a year to get an education. Merit scholarship means they must have a B or higher average in college. In other words, they are serious students. Without this, we're going to lose some of our veterans from getting an education that they should have. And it's just to cover those people that I think is the missing generation. I think if you have another hearing on this, Chairman, I believe that 2024 and 2033 should be combined, and the two bills, because one spells out what the merit system is, the other one spells out how it's going to be executed. But I think we definitely need this. I've had inquiries from two veterans organizations, from their members, that stated they were left out in the cold, and it's just to cover a gap that our federal government, I believe, not on purpose, but because the way the Montgomery GI Bill was written, left veterans without getting an education or support from the federal government to get an education. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Let's let Kevin go ahead first.
Chair Collin, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I represent the Oregon chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. we support the bill. And for all the reasons Mac just mentioned, but also we're going to have veterans who are continuing education. The current GI Bill, the one that's going to be implemented in August of this year, will pay for a bachelor's degree. If somebody wants a master's, this will help them get their master's. A lot of our veterans who used the old Montgomery GI Bill or the Vietnam-era GI Bill are looking to go back to school for any one of a number of reasons. They become injured. They can't do their current job. An education will help them get a new job and be a more productive member of society. Others are burnt out on what they're doing and want to try something new. This will help them get that education and, again, get back into society and be a good, productive member of. Also, quite frankly, some of us timed out on our Vietnam-era GI Bill, and we finally figured out that there's a value to a higher education. This would also help us get that.
Thank you.
I might point out that if they get this merit scholarship, they cannot be under any other federally mandated educational program.
Okay, thank you. I think actually this discussion has raised some questions and made me realize that there was a bit of an error on our part in scheduling and in officially listing both bills for hearing today. So I am going to close this public hearing at this point and continue it until we have a little bit more information that we can talk about it more clearly then. Thank you.
Thank you,
ma'am. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2024 and open a public hearing on 2348. Committee, we're going to take just a little bit of time. This is going to be a little bit of an interesting challenge because we're going to ask a couple of individuals to join us via conference call as part of this discussion. We're going to be hearing from Mark Sansusi, who is the state liaison with the Northwest Region Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, Military Community and Family Policy, and also Rick Masters, the Special Counsel for Interstate Compacts with the Council of State Governments. So if we'll just sort of stand at ease for a moment while we get those individuals on the phone. opened a public hearing on the bill before us, which for us is House Bill 2348. I'm going to, can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm going to ask, first of all, Brigadier General Caldwell to come up to our microphones and sort of introduce what it is that this bill is intended to do, and then I will move to you to ask you to sort of explain the multi-state compact concept and effort. Would that be all right?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. House Bill 2348, I think, is fairly straightforward. And I think Mr. Mark Sansuski can probably give you chapter and verse on it. In essence, what it boils down to is that in many states, you have a fairly common practice in the military of families or soldiers being moved, airmen, sailors, whatever the case may be, on a fairly regular routine. You know, 3 to 4 years is fairly is normally the stationing time that people have in units. And then they're moved. And quite often, of course, it's from one post or one base to another base out of state. A lot of the families, the children in those families, go to public schools in those states. They'll move from Fort Knox, say, to Fort Lewis, Fort Knox, Kentucky, to Fort Lewis. And suddenly a sophomore, junior, senior in high school who has done History 100 in Kentucky gets to the state of Washington or the state of Oregon or any other state. And the History 100 in the state of Kentucky is different in the eyes of those that are looking at it in Oregon or another state, so they end up going back through similar type of educational programs that they've already had. What the compact, in essence, does is says that we're going to work together with the different states to make sure that this doesn't happen. And it can boil down to things like, athletic events, extracurricular events, but primarily educational issues. And I think the bill is designed to try to work with all the different states so they can clarify those differences in the states so these children are not punished, if you will, by the fact that their parents were service members and they were moved from one state to another. That's the general overview. There's a lot more detail to it. It's several pages long, as you can see. And the Interstate Compact is designed to flesh those issues out and make sure that those people are treated fairly and equitably so there isn't those kind of problems from state to state. So that's pretty much the 30,000-foot overview, and I'm sure Mark can give you considerably more detail since it's really his program that he is operating, trying to get it done in the northwest corner of the United States. I'll be happy to answer any questions or Mark.
Thank you. Paul, did you have some additional comments first?
Chair Cowan, General Caldwell and Mr. Sager asked to just pop up to say that right now...
You want to identify yourself?
I'm sorry, yes. Paul Evans, Governor's Policy Advisor of Military and Veterans Issues, and thoroughly confused for the day. But bottom line is the state of Oregon right now is doing most of the things that is in the compact. We are meeting regularly with the Family Support Network and ODE to try to make sure that the kids aren't lost in this process. And our issues with military really have to do with National Guard and Reserve. We don't have an active duty base. I think that the problems talked about in the compact are very real for most states. But one of the things that we've talked about several times in this committee is that we don't have that active duty challenge. So from our perspective, certainly doesn't do any harm, but right now everybody's working as hard as they can to solve the problems anyway.
Yeah, I might just add for the chair, for your edification and that of the committee, is that as Paul indicated, we don't have a major active duty base here in this state. We have a Unitil Army Depot. It's an active duty base, but it's probably got 4 uniformed people, 5, 6, something like that, and that's about it. Most of the folks that this would impact are going to be recruiters who are going to be coming in for the different services that are moved in that fashion. I'm going to guess, and that's strictly a guess, but I think David and I had a conversation about this. I'm going to guess it's around 250, 300, maybe at the top level, that's going to be impacted. And that's not a year. That's probably over a 3 or 4 year period. So if you divide that up and say there's probably 100 a year that are going to be moved in, moved out, and I think that's really the high mark. Our people in the National Guard, we don't move them as often as they do on active duty, and they just don't simply have the impacts because they're already going to a public school in the state of Oregon, so they're going from one state of Oregon school to another state of Oregon school, whereas recruiters, on the other hand, they're coming from all over the country. So that's kind of the impact that we have here in Oregon compared to a state like Washington, who has several major military installations, Navy, Air Force, Army. I have no idea. Mark could probably tell you, but it's got to be in the tens of thousands of different people that are involved in the state of Washington.
Thank you. I appreciate you addressing that because I wanted to get that piece in about the active duty bases. Excuse me. Mark, you want to go ahead and explain this?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you identify yourself?
I'd like to thank General Caldwell for talking and introducing the bill. I really couldn't hear everything he said, and the second gentleman, all I caught was his name is Paul, and I really didn't.
That's all you really need, Mark.
Well, as soon as I can talk again, I'll try to clarify that. I'm sorry about that. Paul Evans is the governor's representative on Veterans Affairs that meets regularly with this committee, so we all know him.
Okay.
And basically, I think the question before us is, first of all, is this a problem in Oregon because we don't have active duty bases, so we are not subject to the kind of movement that individuals in other states may be, but please give us a brief background on your effort around the compact, and we'll see whether we need to step into this.
I would love to, Madam Chair, and I think I can get to that, and I can even give you some numbers on active duty and activated Guard Reserve folks who would be covered by that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm stuck up here in Olympia, and I'd rather be down there, but I have a commitment I couldn't break, so I'm sorry. My name is Mark Santucci, and I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families from the Northwest, and Oregon is one of my states. I did testify in Salem back in October to the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs, thanks to General Caldwell, I believe, among others, and I'm happy to talk to you again about this deal with the Department of Defense's attempt to help transitioning school children who move from state to state and school district to school district.
If I could get her...
DMV is especially appreciative that you're considering 2348 in this hearing, and as an Air Force guy who just did 22 years and moved 12 times with family, I do appreciate it from a personal perspective. If you please bear with me for background, the Department of Defense considers military school children in transition as one of our top 10 key issues for quality of life of military families. I think General Caldwell was referring to most kids moving. The Military Child Education Coalition has studied it, and most military children, we're talking about active duty now, will attend 6 to 9 different school systems between kindergarten and 12th grade, and they frequently move at least twice during high school. These frequent moves do result in educational obstacles, and although many states, including Oregon, frequently do address these concerns for their military kids, there is a lack of consistency between the states that can create difficulties for our military families. Although one state may do things to accommodate, then the next state, and maybe that's not so much the case. And frequently these are regarding kindergarten or first grade starting age, participation in extracurricular activities, timely transfer of records, placement in appropriate courses, support for children of deployed service members, unnecessary duplication of courses, and on-time graduation. I sent Mr. Molina the Coastal State Government's resource kit, which does a pretty good job with frequently asked questions and talks at length, and I know in the interest of time, I'll just try and get to the meat here. The compact was drafted by 18 stakeholding organizations, including the National Association of Elementary School Principals, the National School Boards Association, the National Parent Teachers Association, the National Education Association, and State Departments of Ed in California, Florida, Maryland, and state government reps in Nevada, North Carolina, and Alabama. Now, since we kicked this off a year ago, 11 states have actually enacted the compact since its introduction, and they include Arizona, Colorado, Oklahoma, Florida, Connecticut, Missouri, Michigan, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Delaware. Right now, we have 18 other states with active bills. Your neighbors to the north in Washington here, and in California, there's a spot bill, a placeholding bill for the 2009 session. Because we went over the 10th that triggered the Interstate Commission, the first meeting of the commission were this past October, and they just did a couple of basic things. They voted for some officers, a rules committee, and an operations committee. And the significant thing as it would relate to Oregon is they did vote on the interstate commission fees. They decided that the commission fees, that is the member state paying into the interstate commission, would be $1 per active duty military student ages 5 through 18. Because Oregon had 890 of these active duty students by our June 2008 Department of Defense data count, the fee of Oregon essentially would be $890 charged in the fall of 2009, which I would point out is the next planned full-blown interstate commission meeting where we hope to have more states besides those first 11. Now, I want to point out that although the compact fees are assessed by the number of active duty kids, the compact applies to all children of active duty and activated Guard and Reserve members. I just checked, and in the 81st Brigade out of Camp Murray, Washington, right now is in Iraq, and they have 37 Oregonians deployed and activated. So, technically, they and their families would be covered if they were in compact states. And I know you know better than me that this coming April you have a deployment of some 3,500 Guard members, and while they're activated, they are covered also. And if you're a compact state and those 3,500 people are serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, they do get the same protections. For some perspective, you should know, I know you were, some people were batting around some numbers. Oregon has 4,119 active duty members, spouses, and children. And when you add the spouses and children to active duty, that's 4,119. And when you add Guard and Reservists and their spouses and children, you're up to 28,299 people. Since the compact applies to active duty and activated Guard and Reservists, you can see that at any point based on your deployments, Oregon, a significant number of Oregonians could be covered by the compact. And I do appreciate greatly that as far as active duty, you don't have a major military installation, but I did want to make that distinction with your activated folks.
Could I stop you there for just a second?
Sure.
Let me throw a question in then. Because we have deployed Oregonians doesn't mean the children move from state to state, though. So could you address that a little bit?
Well, the definition is that the compact covers, I can read right from the, probably it's in your bill, but it covers active duty members of uniformed services as defined in this compact, including members of the National Guard and Reserve on active duty orders pursuant to 10 U.S. Code Section 1209 and 1211. So that's, if they're activated and you become a compact state, then they would be covered, even if the families don't move. But again, you know, it seems like maybe they wouldn't move, but let's say a deployed Oregonian who lives in Portland is deployed, and the spouse says, you know, I'm going to go live with Grandma across the bridge in Vancouver. And if Oregon and Washington are both compact states, then that family can go ahead and do that for whatever the family reasons and have the protections. Does that answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Now, Department of Defense is concerned about the military child who leaves Oregon and moves to Kansas as we are to Kansas, back to Oregon or Washington. And that's when we talk about sending and receiving states. So if a family moves into Oregon from another compact state, we kind of are seeking that consistency as far as applying the rules for those folks. And as, again, my example, locally, if you have a family of an activated Portland Guard and they move to Grandma's in Vancouver, you have those protections. As far as your bill is 15 pages, and it covers enrollment issues like records transfer, and that's asking for records to be transferred within 10 days of request. Immunizations, essentially, and I know I'm just trying to, for time, just condensing this.
That's fine.
Immunizations that the family moves into your state, and the compact asks that you allow the kid to start school and have give the family within 30 days to either continue the shots or begin the series of shots that may be unique to Oregon. Entrance ages, in California, I guess you can start kindergarten at 4. I'm not sure if that's the case in Oregon, but if a kid was 4 in California, moved to Oregon and had already started kindergarten. It was like November. The compact would ask that you allow the child to continue to be in kindergarten. Eligibility, like extracurricular activities. I have stories, anecdotes. All-American cheerleader, a junior in high school in Oklahoma. That's like being an All-American high school football player in Oklahoma. And that gal moved to Fort Lewis, Washington with the family in the summer. She moved to a local school district. Because she missed the tryouts, they said, see you next year. And this gal was an Oklahoma, you know, All-American designated cheerleader. So that, and it also obviously does a damage to the kid's identity, you know, high school especially. Other things like not charging tuition when a kid moves from one jurisdiction to another. Others like if a family is deployed and the spouse or the child goes to live with a non-custodial parent like an uncle in the town next door, that you allow the kid to continue to go back to the school he or she was in, but the state is not required to pay transportation costs. The responsibility would be for the family to provide that. There are placement issues. We would like that course placement continue for students. A student moves from Kansas to Oregon and is in advanced placement or an honors program. The compact asks that you continue to place that child in an honors program, and you can subsequently test after you place the kid to make sure the kid is rightfully in the right place, but it asks for continuity. So you first try and place the kid, and then you can subsequently test. Give your school districts more waiver flexibility in their jurisdictions on things like history courses or other types of courses. Granting absences relating to a parent's deployment. In some states, an Army guy may deploy for 15 months, and a family wants to take a week off to be together before the dad or mom goes to Iraq. In some states, it's an unexcused absence, and it's frowned upon. And so we're looking at rules there that would provide that without the family being penalized. So it's graduation issues. The compact has to encourage waiving similar coursework or like coursework. It gives the schools more options on exit exams. And if there's a transfer during a senior year, and it looks like the child would not graduate from a high school in Portland, let's say, the compact asked that the school district would go back to the sending state in Texas and say, does this kid meet your graduation requirements? And if the answer is yes, then the compact would ask that the high school diploma would be granted to the high school kid from the Texas school, because we want to try and facilitate on-time graduations. Now, this past May, I was privileged in Washington State to be the Department of Defense member on the Washington State Task Force, and we met half a dozen times over 7 months. Last year in Washington, the bill passed the Senate, got bogged down in the House. We ended up with a task force, and we spent 7 months, 6 meetings, and we analyzed every provision with more scrutiny than any other state, and I can tell you that because we have 50 state coverage. There were California, Illinois, and Maryland had task forces. And I can tell you that in some cases, I won't even name a state, one of the states was doing a copy and paste effort, taking the Washington task force and sticking our stuff in their own task force report. So we did. And we tweaked language in some areas that satisfied task force members to the point where in November we voted unanimously for passage in 2009. A good thing about some of the changes were they were words that would say, okay, for the honors program, what if we have a class that's full? We changed some language to say if space is available, and there are some instances of that. I can tell you that Rick Masters, if we can get him on the phone, he is the CFG lawyer who I called throughout the 7 months to ask if every language change we made would be considered material or not, because essentially a compact is like a contract. And Rick Masters, it would be telling you, I hope he can be on, that the changes from, you know, space available in different instances, there are about 3 or 4 areas, were not considered material changes, so they don't violate the compact, and the Interstate Commission would accept the state with those tweaks to their language. And that was the great thing about tweaking the language, because different places have different concerns. And so I did send David Molina the Washington Task Force report that was released on December 31st. I know you have lots of
Yes.
You don't have any free time to be reading a 71-page report, but there's some great analysis in there about some of the issues people had and some of the changes that are being looked at. And where we would like, and I'm finishing up, ma'am, essentially, okay, is hopefully that Oregon would be able to enact and become part of this process early on when they're just barely starting to write the rules to put the meat on the bones of what really is the skeleton, which is the compact. So with that, ma'am, I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. That's a helpful background. It kind of helps me get my head around the issue. Yes, we do have your task force report in front of us as of this meeting, so obviously we haven't had a chance to read it. It's frightening to me because it's almost as big as the interim task force report, and you people really do think we have more free time to read than we do, I think. But
believe me, it was pretty... It was a challenge. We met for 6 hours a day, six times out of 7 months, and the chair was very gracious about anyone who had any issues could show up at these meetings. They were public forum, public meetings, and lots of things were discussed. And there's a lot of academic stuff in there. You will see the Assistant Attorney General member has about 5 pages on state sovereignty issues and other issues people would have had on different kinds of legal type issues. So, yes, ma'am, I know if you just got it, certainly don't have time to digest.
Well, it sounds like you've given us a hint on some of the areas we can skip through quickly, too. Thank you very much for that. Rick Masters.
Yes, and you know, ma'am, just to interrupt, you know, in a worst-case scenario, if I haven't already, I can send you the Washington bill where there are those changes that have been vetted by Rick Masters, the Council of State Government's attorney. And that is what's being actively considered up here in Washington at this time. And certainly I think you'd see that in some of those cases where they've added their spaces available and things like that, people may be more comfortable with this.
I understand. I don't think I'm going to ask you to send that to us at this point in time. This is our first hearing on this particular bill, and when we come back for more information, we'll see if we can connect with Rick the next time. Unfortunately, we had technical difficulties today, and leaving a message on his voicemail didn't seem to be particularly effective. So we relied on you today for the background information, which was very helpful, and I appreciate that. What I think we're going to do is move now to a couple of individuals from our Department of Education who would like to offer their input on this bill, and you are welcome to stay on the line, and hopefully we'll be able to hear them if you would like to. Would you like to do that?
Ma'am, I would. I am familiar with Cindy Hunt, who testified after me back in October, so yes, I'd like to listen if you don't mind.
Well, how about that? Cindy Hunt is sitting before us, and as is Morgan Allen. And if you are unable to hear, you can just kind of let me know, and we'll see what we can do about it.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Cowan. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen, Legislative Director.
I will ask you to speak up in hopes that the microphones will pick it up here.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Cowan. For the record, Morgan Allen, Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education. And joining me is our Legal Affairs Coordinator, Cindy Hunt. And we'll do a little of the tag team routine, if you will indulge us a little bit. But as was mentioned earlier, during the interim meeting last October, we came to this committee and raised some issues with the Interstate Compact that is now before you in House Bill 2348. And we're here again to share some information that we hope will aid in your deliberations on this bill. So,
as Morgan's...
That's as far. We're trying to move the microphone closer, but it doesn't seem to be... Maybe you could set it on a chair as close as you could get it to him or something.
I have been able to hear so far, ma'am.
Okay.
Great. As Morgan said, I am Cindy Hunt, Legal Affairs Coordinator for the Department of Education. As I think the prior testimony has indicated to you, what the compact basically does is, in the area of education law, we have school district policies, state laws, federal laws, and the compact adds another layer of legal complexity on top of that.
And the other thing is that in Oregon, as probably all school districts across the nation, on a daily basis, they deal with kids transferring in and out of the districts. There was one district that testified in front of the Senate last week that they had had 50% of their kids leave between kindergarten and fifth grade, to give you an idea of how common this has become in some of these districts. One of the things about the compact is that, like I said, it would add this layer of legal complexity, is that it only applies to the kids of active duty military personnel. So it doesn't apply to them once their parents become veterans, for example, or before their active duty. So as an example of this, this is just one example of the complexity of the compact, is that under the compact it talks about when a child is a resident of a district, and it says it's when their parent or legal guardian, and if they have a power of attorney, is in the district. In Oregon, we're broader than that. We don't require a power of attorney. We just require the person to be in a parental relationship with the child. So one of the children under this would be under Oregon's laws first and only have to have this parental relationship, for example, with an aunt. Then they'd fall under the compact requirements, and I would advise the district to require a power of attorney at that point. And then when their parent returned from active duty, they'd fall back under Oregon laws. And all this done when the child doesn't even move from house to house. That's just one of the issues under this. And with that, I'll turn it to Morgan.
Well, the other thing, Chair Cowan, is that we're assuming that the implementation of this compact would be carried out by our agency, but the bill is not specific. It does not call out the State Department of Education. Specifically, there are a few areas that if you decide to move forward with this bill that we'd ask for some clarification on, and I'll give you four examples. The first, in Article 8 of the compact, it directs the creation of a state council, but currently House Bill 2348 does not create that council, and it doesn't designate the agency that would need to administer that council here in Oregon. The second one, again in Article 8, it directs that the state council is to appoint a military family education liaison, yet the bill doesn't specify which agency would employ or house this military family education liaison. The third, again in Article 8, the compact directs that each state shall have a compact commissioner, but it doesn't specify who that commissioner will be or which agency will house that commissioner. And finally, just a fourth example, in Article 14 of the compact, it gives authority to the Interstate Compact Commission to collect an assessment from the states to cover the costs. I think that was mentioned earlier. It's about, right now, it's set at a dollar. But that formula can be determined by the commission, and that formula could change, and there could be larger assessments in the future. And House Bill 2348 does not include an appropriation mechanism for this money. Another thing that we'd like to point out is, as the bill is currently drafted, it uses federal terminology instead of the proper terminology that you would need for Oregon to match it up with Oregon policy and statute. Throughout the bill, it refers to local education agency, or LEA, which you'll often see in federal legislation or No Child Left Behind or things like that. That is federal lingo for school district. So everywhere in the bill it says local education agency. We would recommend that you change that to school district to make that clear here in Oregon. So.
Okay. Yeah, right now in the bill, local education agency is defined as the Department of Education, so it's kind of problematic. So another thing that we noticed in the compact is there's some little constitutional issues. And yeah, little ones. Oregon has some special constitutional provisions around the separation of powers. Where this is raised is that, as Morgan mentioned, the council directs each state to create a state council. And on that state council, it says there's supposed to be legislative members and executive agency folks. Well, and then it charges the council with doing basically executive branch kinds of things to administer it. Whenever you have voting members from multiple places in government, a separation of powers issue can exist. There's ways around this, but this is something you should probably consult with legislative council about in maybe tweaking this before you move forward with this. The other area that's of a big concern is in the delegation of powers section in the Oregon Constitution. Oregon, many other states don't have this kind of a thing, but basically the power to legislate is reserved to you. You're the only ones that can pass laws in Oregon. You can delegate that power to a state agency to adopt rules, for example. But in the compact, it's delegating this power to the compact commission to go forth and do policies and rules and so forth. So this raises an issue under the Oregon Constitution that, again, I think that you need to talk to your lawyers about how to, you know, possibly alter the compact to make it pass muster under your constitution.
A couple other things that we'd like to note is that the bill would create a fiscal impact for the department. It wouldn't be large, but we would probably need to find some resources to provide staffing as well as any potential. If we were staffing this, we'd be in charge of running meetings, so there would be costs associated with running meetings. And we also believe that we can't really determine because the language in the bill is so vague, but we would probably incur Attorney General's costs in reviewing Oregon policy and statute, perhaps seeking opinions on things that we're doing and how they line up with the compact and making sure that our school districts and our agency are in compliance with the provisions of the compact. And as the bill is right now, there's no appropriation to either the department or there's no special appropriation in the state school fund to help our local school districts because their legal folks are going to have to do the same thing. They'll have to review all their local school district policies and make sure that they line up with the policies of the compact commission. So that's just another thing that we'd like to point out. And the last point we were going to make, which has already been brought up, is there was a task force in Washington, and we also provided Mr. Molina a copy of that task force report, and a lot of the concerns or a lot of the issues that we're raising here today come out in that task force report as well. So when you have an opportunity to review it, you'll see several of the things that we're talking about here today will be in that task force recommendation. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either our the gentleman on the telephone or the folks from the Department of Education at this point? Let me just see if my rough math is correct. Any of you, then, you're estimating at a dollar per child a cost of roughly $900,000.
$900.
$900. Hey, you know, I just get carried away with these zeros. So, okay, yeah, right. So $1,800 per biennium. And then the department's estimate would be around $30,000.
That's correct. Madam Chair, the one thing I add is there's sort of, and we put this in our fiscal impact statement that we sent to legislative fiscal offices, the potential for legal fees and working with the Attorney General's office to make sure that our agency and our districts are in compliance with that.
For economy of scale, if I heard $30,000, that would probably be pretty accurate because up here in Washington, it's around $100,000 annually for 29,000 active duty kids, not counting, again, the reserve. So probably to scale, that may be close.
And Chair Cowan, just so you know, we had our fiscal impact coordinator reviewed several other states that have either implemented this or are thinking about implementing and looked at some of their fiscal estimates that we made. So we tried to present a reasonable estimate of what it might cost our agency comparative to other states' situations.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we appreciate the information. Are there any other questions at this point? I'm not seeing anything, so Mark, thank you very much for joining us and giving us of your time today, and I really appreciate the background information, and we'll see where this goes.
Thank you, ma'am, and you know, if we have another opportunity, we need to get Rick Masters on because many of the concerns expressed by the other testifying folks can be addressed by Rick because he's the interim legal counsel for the Interstate Commission at this time, and he's certainly expert at those types of things. So thank you very much.
You bet. And what we will do is I will ask our committee administrator to get a copy of the printed testimony from the Department of Education to you and to Rick, and then we can come back together at a future time and see where we go from there.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2348, and I think unless there's anything for the good of the order here, I think we are finished for today. Thank you.
Thank you. You just said you're going to send that to him.
To him, yeah.